Okay, so we have Parshas Vayechid. This is in going to be Leah Nishma Stanford M. Alcho, who is the father of somebody who listens to this year. Unfortunately, he passed away today. Parshas Vayechid. Okay, Parshas Vayechid says the following. In the first Rashi, Vayechid Yaakov Eretz Mitzrayim Shvatz Rishonah B'Yimei Yaakov Shnei Chayim Shabbat Shonim Arbuim Lashano. Yaakov lived in Mitzrayim for 17 years. He lived to the age of 147, says Rashi. Lama Parshas Zustuma, why is there no separation between the end of Vayigash and the beginning of Vayechid? At the end of every Parsha, there's like a pay, or samach at the end of the parsha that tells you that there's something, there's a separation in the Sefer Torah between this parsha and that parsha. At the end of Vayeshev, at the end of Miketz, at the end of every parsha, it's like that, not at the end of Vayigash. Vayigash and Vayechi is straight there. If you're a Kohen and you got an Aliyah this past week on Monday or Thursday, you look in the Torah and you're trying to find the place and it's not there. I mean, it's in the middle of a big paragraph. Vayechi is in the middle of a big paragraph. There's nothing there. So what's pshat? Why is it that way, says Rashi? And it answers, the easy answer. When Yaakov Inu died, Nistmu Einehem Belibam Shal Yisrael Mitzaras Hashibud. The eyes and the hearts of Bnei Yisrael closed from the pain of the Shibud. She Yischilu L'Shavam. They started to serve the Egyptians. A very strange Rashi. There is no Shita in the world that says that they started their Avdus when they were after Yaakov Inu died. Let's do the years, guys. They were down there for 210 years altogether. 210 years. Yaakov died 17 years into it. That gives them how many years left? 210 minus 17.
193.
There you go, 193. 193 years altogether that they were there. Okay? There's a machlokis in the Midrash. Whether they were down in Mitzrayim working in Shibud for 117 years after Levi died, or for 86 years when who was born? 86 years when somebody was born. Her name was Miriam. There we go. When Miriam was born, daughter of Yochaved, so that somewhat counts. Except that. So I don't get it. This servitude didn't start now when Yaakov Inu died. Yosef was the king of Mitzrayim. They weren't servants, then they weren't slaves, then. So what does Rashi mean? At that point, their eyes closed. What does that mean? That's number one. Number two, what in the world does it mean that their eyes were closed? What does that mean? I don't even understand what that means. The wording is off. What could that possibly mean when we say such a thing? Says the great and holy Chassam Sofer, who no one is like and no one will ever be like, and he's the greatest human being to have ever existed except for maybe Moshe Rabbeinu. Chassam Sofer says the following. Everybody knows what other men Chava got, right? When they first did their chait in Gan Eden. They were given kusnos for clothing made of leather. They were given to them in Gan Eden. The very first leather jacket was given over to Adam and Chava. There was a his and a hers. And they got those and they put them on. Now, Reb Meir says, in my Torah, it does not say kusnos or with an ayin. It says kusnos or with an aleph. Clothing made of white. And that's very questionable. How do you change the Torah like that? So Reb Meir didn't change the Torah. He just said that the kusnos or that they wore leather clothing was not supposed to be the leather clothing. Now let's try to understand what this means. Leather clothing means there's a skin around Adam and Chava. That meant that there's a separation, a klipa, so to speak. That means a shell of tumah. Something on the outside of them that separates their bodies from the rest of the world. And that's what it is when we put on clothing. We're keeping in the greatness, the holiness of our bodies, and we're surrounding it with something that's made of ore. It doesn't have to be leather. It's a klipa. It's a shell that your levush speaks for you. When I look at somebody, unfortunately, and it's just 100% true, and it's true by everyone, when you look at somebody and he wears something, if I would be sitting here and I'd be wearing a tank top and shorts, people would look at me and say, that's really strange for a rabbi to be sitting here giving a shir wearing a tank top and shorts. That's why I'm wearing a t-shirt and shorts. They can't hear that on the tape. Obviously, that's the reason why you wear a suit. That's the reason why certain people wear certain things, and why there's a dress code, why there's certain things out there. That's the idea. Your levush speaks to people. And the kusnos or ayin vav resh that Adam and Chava wore were covering up the insecurities of their body, and that spoke instead to the physicality of this world, that there's something you need to put on top. Now, there are ways of making your inside show even past your clothing, of showing your or aleph vav resh. There's a way of doing that. Reb Meir showed us how to do it. Reb Meir was the greatest of Tanoim when it came to a certain type of method called pilpul. That meant learning a sugya and understanding every single shita and knowing what they held. Reb Meir was so great that when he used to argue both sides reasons of the machlokas, and tell the reasons for both, and give the arguments for both, and then get them up against each other to the point where his Talmidim had no idea how he paskened. Had no idea. He'd say, yeah, the Ramah says this, Shulchan Aruch says that. Obviously, the Meir was before the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch. But the Ramah says this, Shulchan Aruch says this, here's why the Ramah says this, here's why the Shulchan Aruch says this. Shulchan Aruch asks the Ramah this, and the Ramah answers this. The Ramah asks the Shulchan Aruch this, and that's that. And he'd give this share, and he'd say every opinion, but he'd never say what he held like. Because Ramah was so great in pupil, he was able to figure out everything. The Erevin, Yud Gimel, and Beis, nobody was able to figure out exactly what he wanted. That's the idea. Reb Meir, he found the light, that's his name, Meir, to find light, in the darkness of Torah, in the confusion that is the Torah itself. They're both meant from the Torah, but there's something there. Reb Yehuda was a tremendous gadol when it came to this as well. Shmuel said to his Talmud, Reb Yehuda, Shinina. Anybody ever heard that line? Shinina, oh smart one. Sami Eina Dedain. Blind the eye of this picture that you have. Blind the eye of the picture. Sami Eina Dedain can also be learned as get rid of the ayin. Get rid of that ayin yud nun that you have there. Turn it into an or. Get rid of the klipa of the tumah that's surrounding you and let it be just light surrounding you. Here's the pshat, guys. When Yaakov was still alive, you looked at Yaakov and you saw light. You didn't see the clothing surrounding him. You saw bright light shining from similar to what I talked about over Shabbos. The concept of something shining forth from him. We looked at Yaakov and you saw, you had no questions. You're sitting there like, why are we down here in Mitzrayim? You couldn't ask that question because Yaakov Avinu, I'm sorry, was awesome. You looked at him and you said, this guy is unbelievable. The Shvatim didn't compare to the or, the Aleph of Resh, that stemmed from Yaakov Avinu. So while he was there, their eyes were wide open. The ayin was gone. The ayin was pasuach. It was wide open and the or shone through and they were able to see what they needed. The Aleph of Resh was able to shine through and everything was there, whatever they needed. But after he died, their eyes were closed. It became an ayin, as in they were surrounded by a klipa, that they couldn't see things as clearly. The gullus was strong about them, and the avdus became more manifest. It's not that they were working. It's that they felt different. All of a sudden, they had questions that could not be answered. The shvatim were not great enough to answer those questions. And that's what I meant by yeshibut. A shibut is when you have problems, and you can't verbalize them to the right people, because the people aren't giving you the right answers. That's what I meant by tsaras hashibut. That's when gullus really started for them. And that's what it meant, that when Yaakov Avinu died, their shibud started. That's when the ayin was so bad for him. And I'm going to tell you that this came up later on in the parsha. It's a tremendous idea. In Yosef's bracha, it says the following. Everybody knows how it says by Yosef. Yosef was Bein Poras Yosef, etc. I'm going to say something. Just you're going to have to be a little listen. Vateishav Eisen Kashto Vayefosuz Roy Yadmi Day Avir Yaakov Mishamro Evan Yisrael. Listen to this work. It's absolutely unbelievable. We all know that there were Asarugi Malchus. 10 people that were killed by the Roman government, right? They were killed because of the sale of Yosef HaTzadik. The problem is, there weren't 10 people involved in the sale of Yosef HaTzadik. Reuven had already run away to go do tshuva. Binyamin was sitting by his father. And Yosef was thrown in the pit. So 12 minus 3 is 9. So why were there Asarugi Malchus? That was good, by the way, Nathan. Nathan Goldberg. Got your name on there. So why is there? Why in the world are there Asarugi Malchus? What's the shot? I'm sorry? So there's two opinions. One is that Kadosh Baruch Hu added on to be the 10th, or that Yosef himself added on to be the 10th. Now, I don't understand. Why was Yosef punished that somebody had to die for him? What did he do wrong? Chazal say an unbelievable thing. He went down to Mitzrayim, and he wasn't together with Eishes Potiphar, but he was around Eishes Potiphar. When he went out of the room from Eishes Potiphar, he had an issue, and he stuck his hands in the ground. And the Medrash seems to say that Zerah, these little drops, came from each one of his fingernails. And for the 10 fingers that he had stuck into the ground, 10 drops came out. And for those 10 drops, there were people that had to die. The Asarugei Malchus came out. The Shvatim caused them to be down in Mitzrayim and caused those 10 drops to come out. 10 people had to die from that act. So 10 drops came out from that act. We learn that out from this pasuk. By a fozu, it was scattered by Zroei Yadav, from the Zera of his hands. We don't know exactly how that works, how Zera can come out through a person's fingernails. That we don't understand at all. But somehow it happened, says the Medrash, and that's by a fozu Zroei Yadav. Now, who died for Yosef HaTzadik? Who died to take the place of Yosef HaTzadik? Either the Asarugei Malchus, because I'll tell us, Rabbi Akiva.
which is why Rabbi Akiva is known as Akiva ben Yosef. Specifically, very good. Specifically, that's right. Akiva ben Yosef is supposed to be the idea of he was the son of Yosef. He came from Yosef HaTzadik. That's what he ended up coming from. Guys, the very next words after we go through what happened with his fingers says, Midei Abir Yaakov. From the hands of the strong one of Yaakov. Abir Yaakov, if you take the letters and switch them around, is Rebbe Akiva. Abir is Resh Beis Yud, and the Aleph goes in with the other letters of Yaakov, Ayin Kuf Yud Beis Aleph, is Rebbe Akiva. And Rebbe Akiva comes from the hands, literally, of Yosef HaTzadik. And then he had a Talmud. His Talmud was one who brought Torah back and was able to get rid of the tumah that is caused when a person has such a thing happen. So what do you have? Misham Roa Eben Yisrael. There we have the shepherd of all the children of Israel and everything that needs to happen for Bnei Yisrael. The eventual Stam Mishnah was the Talmud of Rebbe Akiva. The Stam Mishnahs are always like who? Reb Meir. Rosh HaKevis of Misham Roa Eben Yisrael is Mem Reish Aleph Yud, which stands for Meir. And that's the Torah that we got brought back, even though there was tumah that had to happen, Rabbi Akiva had to die. That's the concept of what we have. What do you guys got? First, Lee.
So according to Abishat, that Yosef, the martyr, one of the martyrs died with Yosef and Sarah. So what does he do with that? The Midrash that says that Yosef was supposed to have 12 shvatim.
Same thing. He himself was punished. Himself was punished. There was a punishment in Shemayim as well. You can have two. That I'm okay with. Yes.
So where do you get the Aleph in Yaakov?
Abir Yaakov. I don't get what you're asking. Abir Yaakov, that's how it goes. That's how it ends up going. We mentioned earlier in Parshas Vayishlach, although I was in Eretz Yisrael when I said this, so I'm not so sure I told this to you guys specifically, but in Parshas Vayishlach, there was an argument between Yaakov and Shimon and Levi. Remember that argument? Shimon and Levi heard that Dinah got taken by Shechem, so they decided to fight. So they went up against the city of Shechem. They went up, and we all know what happened, right? They gave them bris milas. They went in on the third day, and then the third day when they were weak, they went in and they destroyed, they decimated the entire city. I don't care how many people were there. The Medrash says either 671 or 24,000. I realize that's a big difference. But either way, they went in and they killed a lot of people. Shimon and Levi by themselves, and by the way, Shimon was the age of 14 at the time, Levi was the age of 13. Very young. I don't know if you guys are around that age. 13 and 14 years old, they went in and destroyed 671 people. This was not an Xbox game. They went in with swords and killed every single person there. Yaakov Avinu never answered them. He went up to them at the end of his life, at the end when everything had happened, they had killed everybody. Yaakov goes up to them and says, what did you guys do? How could you have done such a thing? You did terrible. That's a terrible thing to do. To which they said back, HaKazona Yasa Hosenu. You want our sister to be like a Zona? You want our sister to have like a Zona thing happen to her? You don't want us to act out? You don't want us to fight back? Yaakov doesn't say a thing. Seems like Yaakov's masking, right? Yaakov's okay with that. He's like, good answer. That's that. The end of the story. It's not. Here's the beauty of the Torah. It's just not answered there. It's answered here. He gets back at Shimon and Levi and he's like, hey, by the brachas, look at Shimon and Levi. You guys are terrible. You guys are terrible. Your violence is crazy. You destroyed an entire city and you want to destroy Yaakov Avinu. It's crazy. Because of that, I have to scatter you throughout all of Klal Yisrael. That was his punishment and his answer back to Shimon and Levi. You guys said, HaKazoni HaSaf Hoseinu, that's it. I'm going to scatter you throughout Klal Yisrael. You're not going to have your own portion. Shimon, you're going to be somewhere. Levi, you're going to be all over the place. That's your punishment. What does the Medrash say about that punishment? It was a punishment because now they became the teachers of all of Klal Yisrael. Now that is a punishment. I hear that. Okay, being a teacher, I definitely can hear that. But what? I don't get it. Why did he choose them as teachers? It's not good to have a murderous guy to be your teacher. You know, like, did you get shot? Did you get shot? Like, that's not good. The guy like takes out a gun and shoots you, and this guy can kill 671 people. That's a big yeshiva. I mean, that's a lot of people altogether. What in the world is going on? How could he have allowed it? So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky says something unbelievable. He saw that these two brothers had something that nobody else did. They cared so much for their sister. They weren't doing this out of revenge. They weren't doing this because they hated Shem. They did it because HaKazone Yasa Hoseinu. They felt her pain. They felt what it was like, so they were part of him. They said to themselves, if this was us, you don't think we would have done this ourselves? Our sister is like us. We're willing to fight for our sister the same way we fight for ourselves. So Yaakov Avinu punished them by making them Rebbeim. What was the punishment? You guys can feel other people's pain. You feel what it's like to have bad things happen, and you feel like, mom, it's, just, oh, it's as if it happened to you. That's a perfect Rebbe. A Rebbe who cares so much about his Talmidim, it's as if the pain that his Talmid has is his own pain. You guys will be the perfect quintessential Rebbeim. Shimon and Levi will be the Rebbeim of Klal Yisrael, and thus he scattered them around. They were given this Tafkid to use their kochos in the best way possible. There's a problem. Levi was able to accomplish that very well. Became a great teacher, went throughout Klal Yisrael, became the Levim and the Kohanim, and everything worked out well. Shimon, not so much. We never see Shimon being a teacher. Never happens. Shimon never became that Rebbe, he never went around. Why? What happened to Shimon? So I'll give you the answer. Yosef Atzadik went up to Shevet Levi and said, you guys are going to sit in Mitzrayim and you're going to learn. You're going to sit and learn the whole time. You're given permission to sit and learn while all the other Shvatim had to go out and work. Levi was sitting in the Beis Medrash. He gave their key. He gave his own kids bris milas. He sat in the Beis Medrash and he understood that in order to work hard, in order to get this down, you have to learn Torah. And they sat and they learned all day long. And they understood they had something inside them called kanos. Now guys, there's good kanos and there's bad kanos. Good kanos, a real kanoi, not a good word, kanos. What is it translated as? It's like zealousness, but zealous sounds so wrong. It also means to like act for God. It can be in a good way acting for God, and it can be in a bad way a zealousness that destroys other people. Zealousness does not mean, and to be a kanoi does not mean that you have to get up and you have to be all angry at other people. It's like you're doing something wrong and you're doing something wrong. That's not a real kanoi. A real kanoi is a person who does things properly. He asks, why did you think that was right? Because I'm pretty sure that's not correct. You hear what the other person has to say, and if the person's wrong, you tell them they're wrong. And if the person's right, you say, okay, I hear you. And you walk away. That's a true kanoi. Levi had 210 years in Mitzrayim to work on his kanos and to make it work for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to make it something real. And thus, he did everything correctly, and everything worked out well, and it was all good. But Shimon had no idea how to channel his zealousness. He had kanos, but he had no idea what to do with it. So while Levi used his zealousness to fight for Moshe Rabbeinu by the Egel Azov, to become the Levim and the Kohanim, to become those guys who were ready to fight, Shimon used it in a way that we know later on happened with Zimri. He was willing to do terrible, terrible things. And that's only Shevet Levi knew how to differentiate. Only Shevet Levi, who fought Zimri, guys? Who was the guy who got up against Zimri and said, get out of here? Pinchas, from what Shevet? Specifically Shevet Levi was willing to fight. He was the guy around. Let me understand better. I'll help you understand better with a big muscle. I always thought this was a joke. I never thought that anybody should really answer this, honestly. People have come up to me before. Is it better to marry a Jewish woman who won't keep Hilchos Nida? Or is it better to marry a guy? Which one's better? So now, a Lamdan would ask this question and would say the thumb. A Lamdan would look at it and he's like, oh, he's got to have a thumb. Okay, he's got to have a thumb. Ready for the thumb? He's like, oh. So marrying a woman who's going to be a Nida is a Chiyuv Karis. Chiyuv Karis. Chiyuv Misa involved, something terrible involved. While marrying a non-Jew, it's maybe a lav, so you get Malkus, Losia Kedesha, and according to the Rambam, it's only a Durabanan. So you guys tell me, Kares versus Durabanan. Which comes first? I'm sorry? Can you show it to me?
Did you say that a couple weeks ago?
I did, but can you show it to me? Here's the problem. It comes from this one. Ready? So this is it. You have Karis versus a possible Durabanan. So I don't understand. Of course the Karis is going to win out, so of course you should marry the Goy rather than marrying the girl who's Anita. So I don't get it. What should you do? Says Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, it's because you don't know the Rambam. Hilchos Yisuri Bia. Perek Yud Beis, Halacha Zion. I'm going to translate it in English. Do not allow this sin to be light in your eyes to marry a non-Jew, because even though you won't be killed for it, it contains a loss which is worse than all the other arayas. And that is that the child born from this relationship will not be Jewish. This will also cause you to get together with other goyim, which Hashem has separated us from. See, a proper Torah outlook doesn't just look at the act itself and say you're over on a lav versus you're over on kares. That's not the proper Torah outlook. Proper Torah outlook is look at the whole lada. What will come from that action? Will the child be Jewish or will the child not be Jewish? Now, granted, by kares, it's kares. Marrying somebody, you're going to be over on kares every single time. But the child is at least Jewish.
your child has a chance. You marry the goy, you don't have a chance for that kid. And that's the proper Jewish outlook. And Yaakov Avinu looked at the situation and said, I can use your kanos, but it's got to be used correctly and it's got to be used in the right way, or else it can be much, much worse. Zimri had a pshat. It was a pshat for him, not a pshat for his kids. And because that pshat didn't work for his kids, it can't work. And that's where the Rambam gets his pshat from, and that's how you got to look at it. You got to look at something, and true kanos is looking at not only the act itself, but everything that comes from it. So those who quickly answered, goy, the people who quickly answered that was you, I believe. Be careful, because that's not the proper outlook. That's not the way to answer a question. What's up?
So if what Shimon and Levi did was not for revenge, then why did they kill the whole city? I mean, everyone was
weak. Well, we know from the Ramban, right? The Ramban is the easy answer. He gives three different answers why they felt they had to kill the whole city. One of them is because they were over on the over on one of the Shevet Mitzvah in Al-Havdin. That was one of them, right? They did not judge properly in this situation. They did not judge the person who had raped a girl properly. That's one. The other one was that there was a riot. And when there's a riot involved, the whole city seemed to be masking to it. That's number two. That's one. That's another thing. We said at Chiddush not too long ago that there was that it was an aspect of murder involved. That giving themselves bris milas when they didn't really mean it, and it seemed to Shimon and Levi that they didn't really mean it, was an act of murder, so to speak, where a non-Jew is allowed to be killed for it. The whole city was guilty for that, and thus they killed the entire city. It could also be that they only went in to kill Shechem and Hamor. But when they went in to kill Shechem and Hamor, the whole city stood up and were willing to fight them, and Shimon and Levi just fought back. That's a possibility as well. You can have a bunch of different answers, but that's the basic answer for it. I'm sorry? No, I'm sure there were women and children also, because those were the spoils that they took out of war. Remember, the Shvatim went in and took everybody out? That's what it says afterwards. There were women and children after that. I'm going to say one more vort, guys. This is an unbelievable little vort. It comes from Rav Yaakov and the Chassam Sofer. It's unbelievable. How do we know that the Malchus has to go through Yehuda? How do we know that the kingship has to go through Yehuda? What words tell us that?
In a weird way.
I'm sorry?
It has to come in like a weird way.
No, that's true. But how do we know that it has to be by Yehuda? How do we know Yehuda is the king? Where did it come from? Yaakov Avinu's bracha. Yehuda was told, Lo Yasur Shevet Mi Yehuda, that the rod will never leave Yehuda's hands. Yehuda will always be the king. As soon as they become king, they will never, any longer after that, never not be kings. I'm sorry about the double negative. They will be kings for the rest of their lives. You will not remove that rod, that scepter, so to speak, from Yehuda's hands. Yehuda will be the king forever. That's how we learn it. And mechokik mibein raglov. There will no longer be somebody who can learn mibein raglov, meaning you will never be missing a mechokik from there ad ki avo shilo, until Mashiach comes. Up until Mashiach comes, everything will go through Yehuda. He's there. Let me ask you something. Were the Hashmonaim Tzadikim who fought in the times of Greece?
Yeah.
Were they Tzadikim? They were Gedol, right? How in the world could they make themselves kings? How did they not know this pasuk? The Ramban says the Hashmonai kingdom was destroyed because they made themselves kings. Now, hold on. Were there any Tanoim that lived at the times of the Hashmonaim? Does anybody know? 100%. Shimon ben Shetach, Yeshua ben Prachio, Nitai or Bailey. We have Tanoim of the highest stature. Shmayan of Talion, Hillel and Shammai lived when there were still Hashmonai kings. Granted, there were Hordes kings, but there were Hashmonai kings during the times of the Tanoim. Could no one have gotten up and said, guys, this is wrong. The kingship goes to Yehuda. How could these Gedolim, the Hashmonaim, who were such big Gedolim, they just won a massive war, how could they have made themselves kings? And not only that, how could the Tanoim have allowed it? The Tanoim allowed it. The Tanoim that were living at the time said it's okay. How could they have allowed such a thing?
Right.
Strong question. It's a strong question.
Well, the Hashmonaim were the ones who sort of won the kingship.
So what? So if you win a kingship, you can go against the apostles?
They deserve to be kings.
But you can go against the apostles? It's a straight up apostle in the Torah.
You don't make yourself kings anyway. Yehuda, Yonasan,
Shimon
did never made themselves kings.
Shimon did. Shimon was the very first anointed king.
I thought that was his son.
Shimon was the first anointed king. Shimon was the very first one that was anointed. He was the son of Yochanan Kohen Gadol, the very first one that was there. So why would he allow it? And the Tanoim, guys, there are Tanoim around. There were Rabbanim around. The Rabbanim who fought in the war were around. Why didn't they say anything? How could they not say anything? So listen to this. Rabbi Yaakov says, at the time
of Darius II. They allowed, this was maybe Esther's son, we don't know, they allowed the second Beit HaMikdash to be fully rebuilt. It was started in Cyrus's time before Achashverosh, but Darius II allowed it to happen. Now listen to this. The people that lived at the time, they were all Nevi'im. We're talking Mordecai, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah. We're talking about big guys. Not just some, we're talking about Nevi'im. They knew that the second Beit HaMikdash was not going to be the eventual last Beit HaMikdash. They knew this was temporary. This was not going to be forever. This was going to be a temporary, and either the Beit HaMikdash is going to be destroyed, chas v'shalom, or it would be replaced by the third Beit HaMikdash, hopefully replaced, and something else will come in its place. But this would not be the final line. So why would they need a Beit HaMikdash? They needed a time of preparation. They had to get themselves ready for the final Golos. They knew the final Golos was coming up, and they knew there was going to be a doozy, and crazy things were going to happen. You need to prepare for that. They needed to write down and put in order Torah Shebaal Peh. They allowed shoals to develop. There was no such thing as a shoal before the second Beit HaMikdash was started. No such thing. Shoals did not exist. They needed to have tfilos. Tfilo. The Shemona Esther was created then. Pesukim and Zimra, it was created at that time to help an Israel get themselves ready for what it would be like in a Golos. And of course, just to get themselves ready, stop. Mentally prepared of what it's like. But because of that, they could not allow the second Beit HaMikdash to be like the first one. So they purposely made major differences in the structure of the second Beit HaMikdash. One of those differences is they spoke Aramaic and not Hebrew, even though they lived in Eretz Yisrael. The main language at the time was Aramaic, not Lashon HaKodesh, so that people knew this is not the real Beit HaMikdash. They knew this wasn't. That's number one. Number two, there was no Aron in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Now you could say, oh, they didn't know where it was. You don't think they knew where Yoshio was going? Is it the Aron Kodesh? We're talking about Nevi'im here. You don't think they knew? But they wouldn't put an Aron Kodesh inside. Because why? Because they knew the second Beit HaMikdash cannot be like the first one. If you put the Aron inside, it'll make it like it's the first one. It'll make it like HaKadosh Baruch Hu was together with them. And it's not. This is almost like a ghost dikah, Beit HaMikdash. That's what it's supposed to be like until the third Beit HaMikdash comes. And number three, you cannot allow a king from Beis David. There will not be a king in charge in Beis David, because what might that look like? That might look like Mashiach. And it's not. It's not time yet. That's what they made sure. The Chashmonaim made a mistake. They thought if there's no king from Beis David, then they can do it. They can take over themselves. They can be the kings in place of the kings of Yehuda and give it over to Shevet Yehuda when Mashiach comes, and we'll be willing to give it up. Since it's a temporary Beis HaMikdash anyway, since this Beis HaMikdash is not allowed to have Shevet Yehuda in charge, that there weren't allowed to be any kings, we'll take over. We'll be the kings. We'll be those people in charge. And then when Mashiach comes, we'll readily give it up. That's why Shimon never officially made himself a king. He made himself a Nasi. Unfortunately, Shimon's kids were not like him. And they made themselves like real kings. So although the Tanoim were shrying out loud, screaming out loud, Shimon ben Shattach, and Yoshua ben Prachya, and Nitai Arbeli are screaming out loud, but you can't be kings. They said, we're not really kings. We're regents. We're princes. We're not really kings. And eventually, we're kings. That's what happened with the Chashmonaite kingdom. Says the Ramban, because it eventually got messed over, that's the reason why the Chashmonaite kingdom was destroyed. But this was their mistake. They thought that if Shevet Yehuda can't be in charge, then at least someone should be and will be in charge. But it doesn't take that long for a king to forget. And all of a sudden, it was all gone. Now, when the Chachamim saw that the Chashmonaim had usurped the throne, they had usurped the throne and taken it for themselves, and they weren't going to relinquish it anytime soon. They saw that it was theirs forever. They said, alright, we got to do something for Shevet Yehuda. You know what they did? They made Nesiim. And the Nesiim, the Nasi in Klal Yisrael, would always be from Shevet Yehuda. Thus, Hillel, Rabban Gamliel the First, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel the First, Rabban Gamliel the Second, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel the Second, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and going on and on to Gamliel his son, and then Rabbi Yehuda Nesia, going on until the Nesiim stopped in Eretz Yisrael. Every Nasi was from Shevet Yehuda. Says the Chassam Sofer, they did that on purpose because they needed Shevet Yehuda to have some
something. Because if he's not going to be the king, because the kings are no longer, they're going to be taken over by the Chashmonaim, were there, then we'll at least make the king of the Torah world will be from Shevet Yehuda. The Rosh Yeshiva, the Nasi and Klal Yisrael, that guy will be there. And thus, we have another translation of the Pasuk. Lo Yasur Shevet Yehuda. The scepter will not leave Yehuda's hands. But what happens when it does? What happens when the scepter goes to somebody else? What happens at that point when somebody else becomes king? Mechokek mi bein raglav. Then the Mechokek, the Rosh Yeshiva, the Nasi, will be from Yehuda. He's got to be from Yehuda. And that was the Nebuah of Yaakov Avinu, and that's what they understood. And thus they kept it there. Maybe that was the svar behind Rabbi Gamliel. Everybody knows the Gemara, right? Rabbi Gamliel got into a big fight with Rabbi Yeshua 3 times in Shas. He gets into a big fight with Rabbi Yeshua. He makes Rabbi Yeshua stand on his feet in Brachos, and Dafchav Vav Mabez is where it comes to a head. And everybody stands up for Rabbi Yeshua and says, come on, give it up already. You fought with him in Rosh Hashanah, in a Mishnah. You fought with him in Bechoros. You're fighting him now about Tfilas Marev, Tfilas Arbis. Come on, it's enough, Rabbi Gamliel. It's enough. And they took down Rabbi Gamliel from his position and put Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah in his place. Why was Rabbi Gamliel such a machlok? Why did he care so much about Rabbi Yeshua? What was he going so crazy about? Because who was Rabbi Gamliel? What Shevet was he from? Shevet Yehuda. What Shevet was Rabbi Yeshua from, guys? Where was he from? Who knows? Shevet Levi. Efsher, there's a machlokus, he may have been a Kohen. Possible he was from the Hashmonai kingdom. Now he wasn't from directly the Hashmonai kingdom, as we all know that Hordus destroyed all of them. Maybe he was from a previous generation of Hashmonai kingdom. Maybe he's somehow related to the Hashmonai kingdom. Maybe Rabbi Gamliel was afraid that Shevet Yehuda was being taken out from the Nasi position, that Rabbi Yoshua, who was a brilliant man, maybe he was trying to usurp the Nasius of Klal Yisrael and was going to go to Shevet Levi. To which Yehuda, Rabbi Gamliel, said, I can't allow that to happen. So he was makbid. He cared so much about Rabbi Yeshua today, and he made him stand up and say, you have to follow me. I'm the Nasi. I'm the one in charge. I'm the person who's in charge of Klal Yisrael. Maybe that's why Rabbi Gamliel was so angry at him. And maybe that's what ended up happening. Who knows? That's that. We're going to stop at that, guys. Have a great day.